Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday Casey Filmmaker Series Edish. Welcome, Casey.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
So we have sort of just decided to do whatever we want to do now, kind of loosely agreeing to bounce around between slightly more well-known films and maybe a little more like, hey, let's turn you on to something new films.
Yeah. So this would be...
sort of in the middle.
Kind of in the middle, yeah. Well-known director, Hollywood movie, but... made in the independent style, of course.
Yeah, underseen still.
Yeah, and underseen. So, you know, Soderbergh has much better, much more widely seen films than this one, but this is one of his best, I think.
Yeah, so we're talking about The Limey today, the great, great Steven Soderbergh film from 1999, written by Lem Dobbs. I know that you're going to have a lot of good information about the director's commentary because weren't they both in there?
Yes. Yeah. They're both in there and it's, extremely contentious in like a, you know, friendly way.
I didn't get listen to it, but
you can tell they both like each other, but at the same time, yeah, it's like the perfect crystallization of like the screenwriter's dilemma, you know, in Hollywood,
which is
in the case of this film, this screenplay, this was something that Dobbs had worked on for a very long time. The first draft he'd written when he was like 19 years old.
Oh, wow.
And by the time they're making this, he's already kind of like a industry veteran. And he'd already worked with Soderbergh on a film before this called Kafka.
Yeah.
And so, so it's kind of that thing of he put a lot of his own life and, you know, thoughts on things into this. And everything was kind of there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the side characters and the backstories and so on were all kind of, you know, headed towards something.
Uh-huh.
And Soderbergh took that and cut it way, way back and made a much more streamlined, minimalist kind of film.
Yeah.
From that raw material. And it's just kind of, it's what happens to every screenwriter, more or less, in filmmaking, is that whatever your reasons for the thing that you wrote, it's ultimately, at the end of the day, it's raw material for somebody else to come and kind of make it, you know, make it their own thing.
You got
to
get right with that.
Yeah.
If you're going to write movies, unless you're going to direct them, you got to hand over your baby and watch them, like, cut it to pieces.
And so right at the top...
That's gross.
Dobbs, right at the top, Dobbs talks about, you know, Robert Towne still complains about what Polanski did to Chinatown. And,
come on.
Alain Robbe-Grillet still complains about what Alain René did with Last Year at Marienbad and so on. So, like, even these things that we think of as, like, perfect films.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a screenwriter somewhere going, man, I wish they kept that scene.
Would have been better.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh, screenwriters. I love it because I am one, technically. So this is a neo-noir film, I guess you could call it, sort of a crime film, a revenge film.
Absolutely, yeah.
All of those things are some of my favorite things in movies.
Yeah.
And retribution, someone getting their just desserts is something that has always been a turn on for me in a film.
It's very, very cinematic, very cathartic,
you know?
You set up the villain and then, you know, in the end, they're going to get their just desserts and
And this film opens with such a bang with, and not a bang in a traditional sense, like some big...
A whisper.
Yeah, like action sequence.
Yeah.
But, you know, Terrence Stamp saying, you know, tell me about Jenny.
And just the sounds of the waves crashing on the beach.
Yeah,
and,
which you don't know what that is yet.
Completely black screen. And, It's a great kind of cold open, and like you said, it's very disorienting. You don't know who's talking or where they are, or what's happening.
Yeah,
who he's speaking to.
And then you know the first thing you see is him walk straight into frame.
Yeah.
With the title card next to him, and it's just such a great film entrance.
That song, the Who song, The Seeker.
Yeah, just kicks right in.
Yeah,
little tidbit: Terrence Stamp's brother was the Who's manager.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Yeah, yeah. It's great too because that song has like a, I don't know what you'd call it in musical terms, but it's like a break where you think the song's over, they go bam.
Yeah.
And there's like a bar of silence and then it kicks in again.
So good.
But the way the film uses it, it hits that break and then it just, it never comes up again.
Yeah.
And it's like your first kind of hint, if you know that song well, that like this film's going to kind of
do
a little something different. It's going to zig when you expect it to zag.
Yeah. And since we're on music, I know we're not even in the film at the point where the score comes in. I do want to shout out, I'm trying to shout out more of the, you know,
below the line.
Below the line.
Yeah.
Or, composers above the line.
Sure, sure.
Or are they below the line? I don't even know.
I mean, Cliff Martinez, very much above the line in my
view. Yeah. So he is, the score is so effective in this film, very spare and sparse. And it's sort of, there's this minor key, off key thing it does that's very unsettling.
Yeah.
And I didn't know who he was, but he, you know, he goes all the way back to Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Oh, yeah.
With Soderbergh.
He goes back to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
That's the Cliff from the Red Hot Chili Peppers?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Did not know that.
And I don't know. Do you know what he played in Red Hot? Was he like a, I don't know. He wouldn't be bass because that'd be Flea.
Yeah.
Unless he's in an earlier incarnation or something.
Believe it or not, I read that. I went through my rock bio phase and I read that Anthony Kiedis book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think Cliff might have been one of the first guitar players.
Okay.
Because they famously just cycled through a bunch of guitar players over the years.
So I don't think he's with the band anymore, but I think he...
No.
You know,
he left early.
He transitioned into becoming more of like a film composer.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's worked with Soderbergh a lot and he's responsible for some of my favorite scores in film.
Yeah, and the other person I want to shout out, and we're going to talk a lot about the editing in this film.
Oh, yeah.
The great Sarah Flack.
Yes.
She's unbelievable. And one of maybe easily top five edited films for me, editing job.
And a frequent collaborator with Sofia Coppola, too.
Yeah, so she did Kafka, Schizophilus, The Limey, and Full Frontal with Soderbergh. And then, obviously, Lost in Translation, Marie Antoinette.
Everything after
Somewhere.
From Lost in Translation onward.
Yeah, and The Beguiled. And then another couple of great movies, Dan in Real Life, Away We Go. She, you know, she's known for working with independent films mainly.
Yeah.
But the editing in this movie just blows me away every time I see it.
It's, yeah, I mean, this film wouldn't work without, you know, that very, very important contribution. And Soderbergh tells a story about, you know, the screenplay was written in a more linear fashion, and the first cut of the movie was more linear.
Oh, interesting.
And he said they had the screening, and it was like, it was just dead, you know?
Really?
It didn't have, like, any of what
the
we think of as the film now.
Uh-huh.
And so even though he had already taken steps during the shooting to film some of the dialogue scenes in multiple locations and kind of cut around there, they had done some of that
that
first cut.
Okay, I wondered about that.
Yeah.
Because
so
I figured—
it was like reshoots or something.
Yeah, no, I just figured the only way to do that was to— know you're going to jump cut around and then just shoot stuff in multiple places so you have that freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was, you know, Soderbergh had already done this a little bit in Out of Sight, which he had done just prior to this. So there's the kind of the love scene between George Clooney and
Jennifer Lopez.
And which is itself kind of modeled after another famous sequence in a Nicholas Roeg film, Don't Look Now.
Right.
Where basically it's a couple having sex, but you're intercutting that with them like getting dressed afterwards.
Yeah,
and, and sort of you're jumping all around in time.
So effective.
And it's kind of like, it's sort of, it's more like the memory of that event than like a straightforward depiction of it.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of puts you in this interior, thoughtful, pensive, contemplative kind of mindset. And it removes the film from like the present tense, and it becomes this thing that is kind of like, you know, woven together from the past and the present and maybe the future.
Yeah. And what it allows too is for you to make a really tight 94-minute movie and not feel like you're missing out on anything.
Because he can do so much with just sitting on a shot of somebody thinking, like Terrence Stamp on that airplane.
Yeah.
And you're just watching the light from the window move across his face and
so
his eyes in the distance.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's sort of, it harkens back to this kind of Soviet film theorist, Lev Kuleshov, who had the famous Kuleshov effect, which is, you know, the example he gives, if you show like a picture of a boy and he's just kind of got a neutral expression, and then you show a bowl of soup, you think, oh, that boy's hungry. But if you show like a casket, you know, oh, he's very sad. He's like in mourning or, you know, so it's like the thing that you cut to, that you intercut with this shot of the actor. That's what kind of creates the meaning.
Yeah, yeah.
And the actual shot of the actor thinking is very open-ended and could kind of be anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, Soderbergh has these shots of Terrence Stamp where he's just kind of by himself.
Contemplative, yeah.
Contemplative. And yeah, you can use that for so many different purposes. So that gave them a great amount of flexibility in the edit to really create those moments of thought whenever, you know, it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah, I bet this edit was fun and also a slog for a 94-minute film.
Yeah, so, you know, so they had that initial screening. Soderbergh was like, oh, we're in big trouble. We got to, like, really, really reconceive this whole thing.
Yeah.
And so apparently he went away, came back the next day with all these notes and, you know, and just said basically, like, we're going to take the whole thing apart and build it again.
Wow.
And Sarah Flack was obviously up for the challenge.
Sure.
And like I said, he had already shot some of the sequences of the film in multiple locations, so they could intercut that stuff.
Yeah.
But basically Soderbergh said, like, let's take that as our model and make the whole film like that.
Right.
And luckily he had already had enough footage of, you know, the thinking shots and so on.
Yeah.
That
really works.
Yeah. That he could use all that. And there were even other images, like, for instance, Terry Valentine on the beach on his back with his hands raised up.
Uh-huh.
You don't even know who that is when you first see it in the film.
Yeah.
But it's just an image that foreshadows what's to come, that there's a story about vengeance and it's a story about somebody's going to get kind of what's coming to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah. And so they started, and Soderbergh says during that process, like, he would push it too far and they would screen it for some people. They didn't do traditional test screenings.
Right.
He only screened it for, like, friends of his, people in the industry, people whose opinion he really trusted.
Right.
And also who had a close enough relation to him that they could be brutally honest if something wasn't working. And yeah, they just kind of had this back and forth about, how do we make this, you know, what's the right balance between too nonlinear and not nonlinear enough?
Because you got to follow that story.
Yeah.
It can't be at the expense of that story. So, you know, you've got all the jump cutting, which I love. And then another great device, which is another one of my favorite editing devices, is the dialogue wraps.
Yes.
Where sometimes it's dialogue from the previous scene wrapping to the next or previously. And then sometimes it's stuff completely from different scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, really effective.
Yeah, just bounce around in time. And Soderbergh says that for him, like, the reason it works on this film is that it is a fairly basic skeleton of a story.
Really basic.
Yeah.
Guy comes to America to kill a guy.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a little bit of backstory about him and his daughter and so on, but it's very, very straightforward in that way. And so because the kind of the backbone is so straightforward, that's what gives him the flexibility to be able to jump around in time and do all this kind of thoughtful stuff, because if you combine that with a more complicated plot,
You're screwed.
You're in a real difficult, you know, only for diehards kind of territory.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, you know, an audience is more willing to go along with it because they can still keep track of, like, what that main story beats are.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the one thing we also should mention, so people know what we're talking about, if you either haven't seen the film before, if you saw it and didn't fully understand what was going on, Soderbergh was sort of the first person to de-age an actor, but not digitally.
Yes.
He very smartly was able to finagle Warner Brothers into giving him full rights to the 1967 Ken Loach film Poor Cow.
Poor Cow, yeah.
When Terrence Stamp was a young man.
Yes.
And used this as flashback. And I remember seeing this in the theater and my mind being blown when that shit came on screen.
Yeah.
Because it was so effective. And I was like, why has no one ever done that before?
I know. And so Soderbergh on the commentary, Soderbergh and Dobbs say that they were trying to figure out if anybody had done this before. And
I had never seen it.
There's a handful of things. Like, there's a John Wayne film called The Shootist.
Oh, I know that movie. Yeah, that was his last film.
Yeah. Where they use, you know, clips of John Wayne playing like a cowboy earlier in his life and so on. But it's a much more, like, limited kind of deployment of that. You know, like a few clips at the beginning of the movie, and that's kind of it.
Yeah, this serves really the plot in a lot of ways to show this flashback of him as a young man, as a petty criminal, and intercut with some of that stuff was new, right? The daughter peeking in, or was that all from the film?
I started to watch Poor Cow. I didn't make it through the whole thing. I watched, like, the first half hour or so just to kind of get a feel for it. And I meant to finish it. I will at some point. But the one thing that I did notice that they did to the footage from Poor Cow is they put, like, a heavy sepia tone over it.
I think that was probably to match other stuff, right?
Yeah, to match other stuff that they shot in addition, like the daughter looking and so on. And also just, to probably just for the audience to make it a little less jarring.
Yeah.
Because Poor Cow, as it is actually like filmed and released, is a very like 60s bold primary color kind of vibe. And so it looks beautiful.
It's probably weird to see it that way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, very strange.
The real way.
like watching, because for instance, I got to the scene where Terrence Stamp is playing that Donovan song, Colors.
Yeah.
And, which is like the ending of this film, The Limey. And
singing about freedom.
Yeah. And it's a very different feeling in that film.
Yeah.
It's more of like a, it doesn't have as much of like a melancholy feeling to it the way it does in The Limey, because
yeah.
you know what happened afterwards. But in that film, yeah, it's just like a very beautiful kind of open moment.
Yeah.
And with the bright colors and everything, it's like, it's a much cheerier kind of scene.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting how we never fully get to know Jenny.
Yeah.
Like he doles out just enough and it's very sparse.
Right.
In the flashbacks. He doesn't overdo it. This could have been in someone else's hands 30 minutes longer.
Sure.
And I think maybe suffered for it.
Yeah. Could have had like actual dialogue scenes with that actress and
yeah.
kind of a flash forward, flashback. And yeah,
I don't think you need it.
Yeah, you don't need it. And it's almost, it would be working against the kind of the theme of the film of memory, you know, of
right.
memory and fragments of memory and the subjective way we remember things. And to show a full scene play out like that, it would kind of be, well, whose perspective are we in? Because, you know, Dave would not have been all around for this,
yeah.
you know, if it's his daughter interacting with like Terry Valentine or something. So,
he wasn't around for a lot of it though, because he has that one great
right.
line about, you know, I watched to grow up in increments.
In increments, yeah.
So sad.
Between like stints in prison.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's really hit me more than ever. I mean, I've seen this movie a bunch of times. Hit me more than ever this morning when
yeah,
I watched
yeah,
it,
yeah.
by the way. About what this movie really is about. And it's about a father who failed his daughter.
Right.
Repeatedly and is trying to make up for it in a way by killing the man who he feels like killed her, which he did.
Yeah, which he did. But what he comes to understand is that even though Terry Valentine was the one who literally killed her, that he as a father bears a great deal of responsibility for
yeah.
why she was in that predicament to begin with. And
yeah.
you know, the game about she's going to call the cops and all that.
That whole thing
yeah.
mirrored his exact experience with her.
Yeah.
That was such a, I mean, I love that scene.
That's such an emotional scene. It kind of comes out of nowhere and like
really
hits
got
you.
Me today.
Yeah, like, same.
I was in my living room this morning just like almost crying.
Yeah. Well, the score is actually very
so
like emotional in that scene.
Yeah.
And it's
a gut punch.
It's like an epiphany that he has. You know, he very quickly, like the whole thing just clicks into focus and he understands
yeah.
like right away that I have a lot more of this responsibility that I have to accept.
Yeah.
And for me to just, you know, take the life of this other guy is not really what it's about, you know, for
yeah,
him anymore.
Because he's almost would have been taking revenge on himself.
Yeah, exactly.
In some ways.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about that
right.
later. But let's talk about Terry Stamp for a minute.
Yeah.
I saw that this was written with Michael Caine in mind.
Right.
Which would have been fucking great.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
But I can't imagine, like, from the moment Terrence Stamp shows up, you get a sense as a viewer that like nothing is going to fucking stop this guy.
Right.
He is going to do what he sets out to do. You never see him. He doesn't change his clothes, I don't think.
No.
He's
no.
a very simple man
yes.
with simple needs. You
yeah.
get the feeling.
Yeah.
And it really comes in full focus with that first warehouse confrontation.
Yeah. You just get the sense that he's like this unmovable force. And
yeah.
Yeah, like you said, nothing's going to stop him, deter him. He is just this single-minded, like, strong, you know, vengeful person.
Yeah, but as this old guy.
Yeah, yeah.
There's really, it's a bit of a magic trick that he comes across as
threatening or
so
dangerous.
Threatening.
The way he can walk into that warehouse with
oh my God.
All the hoodlums, like, hanging
yeah.
around. And
take a beating.
Yeah.
And, like.
And yet you still are never really in doubt that he's
yeah.
going to come out on top of all
those dumb
that.
Shits didn't check for another gun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he just goes in there and wastes them. And, you know, there's so much that happens off screen in this movie. And I'm always a big fan of that, especially
yeah.
when it's violence. this implied violence. All you hear is the gunshots and that dude hauling ass out of there.
That's a funny moment in the commentary because it was written like that in the screenplay, that the camera would stay outside.
Oh, really?
That he would go back in and you would just see hear the gunshots, basically.
Oh, cool.
And the one guy running out. And so on the commentary, Lim Dobbs complains, especially about a reviewer in Variety that talks about the bravura direction of Steven Soderbergh in the scene.
Yeah.
He's like, it was in the screenplay, you know? Like, it's very, very funny.
Tell him I'm fucking coming.
Yeah, with the blood on his face and everything.
God damn, dude.
Yeah, that scene, too, you can definitely see kind of the origin of the style that he would later deploy quite a lot in a film like Traffic.
Yeah.
Where he's really not controlling the lighting. It's all kind of available light. It's this really green, like fluorescent, unflattering light.
Yeah.
And the windows, when you can see outside the warehouse, are just completely gone. Just like blinding white light. Ed Lockman, the cinematographer, I believe comes from more of like a documentary background. And so he had that tool where he could kind of, let flares go, let blown out windows go, and really just concentrate on like the feeling of the moment and the immediacy of it all.
Right.
And not get too like caught up in trying to have it quote unquote perfect, because it's the imperfection that gives the scene its energy, gives it that edge of danger.
Yeah.
Like you're in new territory and you don't know exactly how it's all going to turn out. It has like a little bit of an edge or a danger to it.
Yeah, and it's very stylistic at times. Like it kind of alternates between, partially because of the locations, and that was another thing I wanted to mention, this gorgeous house on the cliff.
Yeah.
And then this gorgeous place in Big Sur.
Yeah.
Set against like the worst shit happening, this violence going on.
And the Pacific Coast Highway and
That juxtaposition is really interesting to me. But you've got these really beautiful shots, but then it's so stylish at other times, either in those flashbacks where
like the light leaks, the kind of the
the light bleeding,
those vertical bands and so on.
And like literally using like a flashlight on these actors' faces.
Yeah.
Which is what they had to have been doing.
Right.
Which is I like that kind of style when it's when it doesn't feel like style for style's sake.
Right. Yeah. It's got a real purpose. It has the sense of, because these are memories that Terrence Stamp can't literally have.
Yeah.
There's something that he's imagining that he's putting together in his head from what he knows about Valentine, what he knows about his daughter.
Right.
And how he imagines these things might have gone down.
Yeah.
So and obviously they're very charged memories because it's his daughter being murdered, essentially. Uh-huh. And so, he films them in such a way that they stand out from the rest of the film, not in a jarring way, just in a kind of an intensity way.
Yeah, I think the key is they're so brief.
There's these quick little flashes.
Yeah, very quick. I mean, they're almost, technically they're flashbacks, but when you think flashback, you think of a scene.
Right.
And it's not a scene. They're just these little brief moments. Just
little fragments.
Yeah. So effective.
Yeah.
So it's at this point that we finally meet Terry, Peter Fonda, who's so good.
Oh, yes.
And it's interesting because he, throughout the film, he just conveys this Peter Fonda, happy-go-lucky kind of 60s.
Absolutely.
Former hippie vibe.
Yeah.
Even when, on the way up to Big Sur, when this guy's coming after him to kill him, and he's just sort of joking around.
Yes.
Like, he's like, nothing is ever, even under threat, he's never taking it that seriously.
He's just in denial, and he's lived such a charmed life that he kind of
he's
feels
a rabbit's
invincible.
Foot.
Yeah. There's that great scene where Barry Newman, who's like his security consultant or whatever.
Oh, man. So great.
He says, "How do you keep getting so lucky, Terry?" He goes, "I learned to skate when I was a little boy."
Yeah, and apparently, then exits his frame right then.
Yeah, and so apparently cool. That was a line that Peter Fonda ad-libbed and is something that he says just in real life anyway. Yeah, it's like a Fondaism. Yeah.
R.I.P., man.
I know.
He died like less than a month ago.
I know, and I was like surprised when it happened because in my mind he wasn't that old, but in my mind he was kind of frozen at the age he was in this film.
Right.
You know, and I had to realize this is a film from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? So
it's fucking 20 years.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
He looks a lot like his dad in this movie, too.
He does. He does. And I, maybe this is a good time to talk about the casting in general of the kind of the symbolic weight of a lot of this casting, that you have Peter Fonda, who we think of maybe as like the guy in Easy Rider and this icon of 60s or 70s
yeah,
new cinema, the counterculture, the hippie movement. Yeah, just this icon of the 60s. Terrence Stamp in his own way is that as well,
yep.
although not as much of a pop culture icon necessarily, but he's in a lot of great 60s films.
Sure.
And I think in particular of his role in a Pasolini film called Theorama, mm-hmm. where he's this young, handsome, mysterious figure who comes into the life of this kind of bourgeois family and one by one starts sleeping with all of them and throws the entire thing into chaos.
Yeah.
And he definitely carries that energy of the 60s. Then you have like Leslie Ann Warren.
So great to see her.
Who I was less familiar with, but apparently kind of a fixture of like 70s TV films especially and a lot of TV shows as well.
I mean, she was Miss Scarlet and Clue.
Yeah.
One of the great movies.
And I have to see that one. And then you also have like the hitman, the older hitman of the two, not Nicky Catt, but
this other guy,
Joe D'Alessandro, who is in many of Andy Warhol's features.
He's the Warhol guy.
Yeah, and Paul Morrissey as well, who you know worked with Warhol. So you have these kind of people that are like
you're forgetting
symbols.
Somebody.
Yeah, who am I forgetting?
Louis G.
Oh, of course. Yes, yes.
If I was being honest, dude. And making a real list of my favorite actors of all time, Louis Guzman would be like top 20.
Absolutely.
I love him in every single fucking thing he does.
Yeah. I feel like I don't see enough of him, you know?
He's so good.
You know, Boogie Nights or Carlito's Way.
Yeah,
or...
which I just did Boogie Nights yesterday for the show. Yeah. So it was great seeing that again. And he's like peak Louis G in that
man.
Movie.
he's the best.
Jack, when are you going to put me in one of your movies?
talk about a commentary track. There's a commentary track. There's two commentary tracks on Boogie Nights. And in the second one, it's like a cast and crew. So it's Paul Thomas Anderson talking to like all the cast members.
Uh-huh.
And
even Bert?
No.
Bert
was not involved. No, no.
Of course.
But he kind of... Every time there's a Louis Guzman scene, he's like, do you think Louis Guzman was stoned for this? Do you think he burned one before this take?
Oh, no way.
And they're all just like, yeah, I think he did. Or no, I don't think he did on this one.
I like knowing that.
Yeah,
That's great. He's so good in this too because besides just the fact that I'm in love with Louis Guzman, he's got everything to lose.
Yeah, yeah.
And he still wants to help this guy
right.
because of this girl in his acting class.
There's something very like noble and grounded about him. I think him and Leslie Ann Warren, their two characters really ground the film.
Yeah.
Because they're more like everyday working people in Hollywood. And they're the kind of people that they never became like big stars or whatever. They're just normal kind of middle-class people living their life. Leslie Ann Warren is still involved a little bit in show business.
Yeah.
She seems to be like working on like a TV series or something.
Yeah. Pretty low level.
Yeah. But they're both just kind of, they're out there doing their thing, you know,
yeah.
and they're living it one day at a time. And, that they give such great contrast to, you know, the Peter Fonda, like the kind of like guy who cashed in on all the 60s kind of zeitgeist or somebody like Wilson, who is just sort of like this artifact who's almost been frozen in amber.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's come back.
He doesn't fit into the modern world.
Yeah,
certainly
yeah.
not in L.A.
Exactly.
It also has that Stranger in a Strange Land vibe.
Fish out of water kind of thing. Yeah.
There's so many great lines in it. But since we were on Louis G and Leslie Ann Warren, there's that great exchange toward the end. When they get out of the car and they're sort of walking by themselves and Stamps up ahead, he goes, you ever even understand half the shit this guy's saying? She says, no, but I know what he means.
Yes, yeah.
Such a great line.
It's a great, classic line. I love the line that Guzman has when they're at Valentine's.
The pool?
Yeah, the pool. And he points out, he kind of gestures out towards the smog. He's like, you know, you could see the sea out there if you could see it.
One of my favorites.
Amazing.
Well, it kind of overshadows right before that. He also has a funny line.
Yeah.
Terrence Stamp says, what are we fucking standing on?
Yeah.
And he just goes, the truss.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
There's something about like the simplicity of that exchange.
Oh, yeah. Soderbergh, like if you look at his Twitter account, he's always quoting lines from movies to the extent that he posts because he doesn't post all that often.
But, oh, really?
But you can tell he's a real like admirer of like the great pithy like single line from a screenplay that just encapsulates so much and is infinitely quotable. I feel like The Limey is one of those screenplays that has like dozens of those lines.
It does. And I don't think I really realized how many lines it had. And I found myself, because I don't think the Limey is like, oh, all the great lines from that right. film, like yeah. I do others.
Yeah.
But there are so many I have written down here. When he first meets Leslie Ann Warren, and she's like, she told me she didn't have a father. And like, he fully owns it. He never makes any excuses.
Right.
And he says, how are you going to keep her down on the farm once she's seen L.A.?
Yeah.
Such a good line.
It makes me think of that line from Big Lebowski. It's like, how are you going to keep her on a farm when she's seen Carl Hungus, you know?
Oh, dude, I bet you
yeah.
they ganked from this thing,
yeah.
huh?
Yeah, well, I'm maybe. Trying to think, because Lebowski came out around the same time, right? 99, 2000, something like that.
Oh, maybe so. Even,
maybe. So, I don't know. They might both be kind of referencing some prior saying, like, how are you going to keep him on a farm when yeah. XYZ?
No, that's true.
Yeah.
And then there's the other line. It's just so cutting. And I love a line that, like, just a couple of words can just, like, slice right through you. But when she's talking about Jenny, he says embarrassed. She goes, not embarrassed. He goes, ashamed. And she says, not ashamed, disappointed.
Which is the worst of all.
The worst of all.
It's like when your parents say, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed.
Oh, God,
it's like,
damn,
oh,
dude.
Man, I wish you were angry.
Just be mad
just
at me.
Just be pissed off. Yeah, that's fine. You'll get over
so
it.
So much easier.
Yeah.
And then actually in that same very scene, when she goes, so what's, you know, what's the idea here? You and Terry Valentine at 20 paces? And he's like, you know, sounds about right or whatever.
Right.
She goes, oh, you fucking guys and your dicks, man.
Yeah, yeah. I love that perspective is, you know, it's in the film. And
such good writing.
Yeah, yeah. It's very self-aware without being flashy, you know? It's just kind of like, come on, really? Like, this is what you're going to do? You're going to, like, come to America, big swinging dick, and just kind of, like...
But that's the plot.
Like, fix it all.
There, and so, that's sort of what I love about how he goes about it is there's no plan. There's no scene where... He's like, you know, right, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, right.
Like, he's just like, all right, I'm going to go to the party and kill him.
Yeah.
And Louis Guzman is like, no, 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 get out of here.
Yeah.
Although he fucking kills that guy.
The headbutt.
And that's the way they shot it is
over
so
the
great.
Shoulder. Yeah. Just during a dialogue scene with Peter Fonda
and
Barry
just,
Newman.
He turns around and it had already happened. And all you see is Terrence Stamp, like, straightening his jacket.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so matter of fact and just kind of,
oh, God.
The headbutt is a very kind of, that seems like a British thing, you know, like kind of like a, just like a rough kind of.
It's like a street move.
Street move, exactly. It's not flashy. There's no guns or anything. It's just kind of like very simple and to the point.
Well, speaking of Boogie Nights, though, that guy is, I don't know if you recognize his face. He's been in a gazillion movies.
Mm-hmm.
The one he kills, though.
Oh, yeah.
He was the guy in the donut shop.
Oh, yeah, totally
pulls
it is.
Out that fucking hand cannon.
Yes, he starts the whole massacre that goes down there. Yeah.
And I looked him up. I was like, oh, I bet he's, you know, those are the only two things I know him from. And he's been in like 100 movies.
A million
movies.
Things. He's got one of those faces. That
that's
kinda,
pretty great.
Yeah.
And then I also loved all the stuff between Peter Fonda and his young girlfriend, because it just shows him as so carefree and like I'm the coolest fucking guy in the world. Like when she's talking about the 60s and he has that great line. He's like, it was really just 66 and the first part of 67. That's all there was.
That's it. Yeah. That's all there was. You know, the rest of it's just kind of whatever. Yeah.
I mean, there's so much hubris in that, you know,
it's just kind of like he's somebody, I mean, it's like the perfect kind of boomer, I don't know, thing where you're just waxing rhapsodic about.
I know they thought so much of
bygone
themselves.
Era, and you know, like the way he's almost like a mystic about it or something.
Yeah,
you know?
When she says she's talking about the Jefferson Airplane poster, she goes, "I like those colors," and he goes, "We all did." It's like such an obnoxious fucking thing to say.
She says something like, "You've got that same poster in your office or something." He's like, "No, they're different."
Yeah. Well, and later on when she says, you know, "You've told me the story before."
Yeah,
like that's such a interesting thing to put in a script.
Yeah.
Because it says a lot about this guy who clearly just fucking tells the same
the
stories
raconteur,
over
he's
and
kind
over.
Kind of trading on, again, he's been rehashing the same 2-3 year period, you know, rode it all the way to the bank kind of thing for his whole life.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about the introduction of his character because it's done so amazingly well. It's a scene with Adhara, the young girlfriend, and him at the pool. And there's almost like a trailer for his character that plays out with this Holly song, King Midas in Reverse, playing,
great
where
song.
You actually see at one point, you're seeing all these flashes forward of like Valentine at his cabin later in the film, or Valentine driving down the Pacific Coast Highway later in the film, or even a shot of a billboard for American Express with Peter Fonda, you know? And so...
Remember since 64 or whatever?
Yeah, and you have this blend of Peter Fonda's real-life persona and the character, and his status is kind of like the symbol of the 1960s counterculture.
Yeah.
And it all just blends together in this really, really cool way of introducing his character. And then as soon as it's kind of out of that trailer part, there's a very telling line where, you know, she comes out of the pool and he's like, God, you're beautiful. He says, you know, I told your parents, you know, when they were expecting you or something, you know, you can't go wrong with like the name of a constellation.
Right.
And that's why they named her Adhara. And now he's dating her. You know, he knew her parents before she was born.
I did not pick up on that.
And it's a total.
I remember him commenting about the name, but I did not pick up
on
that.
He was friends with her. So it's this classic.
And
like,
now she's 20. Yeah. So she's fair game.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. So you just get in that tiny little, you know, line of dialogue, you know so much about his character and that he's kind of forever chasing youth and wants to remain as he was maybe when he was in his 20s, that he's trying to recapture that or just keep it going. Yeah.
Man, I've never noticed that in all the times I've seen this movie.
And you kind of, you know, it's because he's a very wealthy guy and he's a very powerful, influential guy. And so he's one of those people that, you know, can have this like never ending parade of, you know, young, beautiful women in his life.
Yeah, and there's so many, I mean, that just speaks to this film. There's so many little nuggets. It's a movie that you really like, if you pay attention, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I mean, it's a brilliant movie. It's not just this sort of in-between movie that he made after Out of Sight and before Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people might consider it that aren't too familiar with it.
Right, like a minor note or something. But
yeah,
it's not at all. And yeah, like you were saying, like the dialogue, it's a screenplay that has obviously been worked over and thought about for a very long time.
Yeah.
There's all these layers and all this depth to it, even though it is like a fairly straightforward story. Nothing is in there just by chance. Like it's all been kind of hashed out for a really long time by the screenwriter.
The post-pool party chase down the mountain is so great. Yeah. And it really speaks to the sort of realistic, sloppy nature of how he did a lot of this stuff.
Right.
None of it is slick. That chase down the mountain, and then you've probably not driven in the Hollywood Hills and places like that, but there are these crazy switchbacks and, you know, tight turns where, like, you know, you got to drive really slow. You can't drive fast down these things.
Yeah.
And that one part where he's, what's the bodyguard's name, the head dude?
I'm trying to think. It's not Newman. Barry Newman is the actor because he's in Vanishing
Bill?
Point. Yeah, it might be Bill.
I think his first name's Bill, but they call him by his last name, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But he, you know, wheels around the corner and he can barely even make that turn.
Right.
And it's not like a slick stunt move. It's really real.
Yeah.
And how that, it just plays out so sloppy. And then it hit me that, like, these are two, like, seniors going at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, he didn't cast some young, and all the bodyguards, they're not like these sort of stereotypical trope tattooed like young strong men.
Right.
They're all these sort of old guys with beer guts that you know fucking killed dudes.
It's funny, when Adhara has that line to Peter Fonda, like, who's that scary guy in the house?
Yeah.
But she's talking about the guy that he headbutts and throws over the...
Yeah.
He's not scary. That scary, But maybe he just has a certain vibe about him, like he means business or something that
she picked up
on.
I'm just realizing where else I saw that guy. It was in Lebowski.
Oh, yeah.
He's on the bowling team.
I think
he's one of John Turturro's bowling partners.
Totally. Yeah, I can kind of see him like polishing
the ball.
With like his gut hanging
out. I'm telling you, man, he's everywhere. That's so good.
Maybe he might be the guy that does the little dance after he does the strike or
something. That's totally the guy. Yeah. He does the little hippie shake.
Yeah. A little shimmy.
That chase downhill was just so brutal. And Terrence Stamp, you know, grabs the wheel from the passenger seat and stomps on the gas to reverse into the
into the car and knock it off the cliff.
So badass.
Yeah. And that, again, like the guy who's playing the security consultant, Barry Newman, he's in this great 70s film called Vanishing Point.
Yeah, Vanishing Point.
That is
great.
You know, kind of like a feature-length car chase, more or less. It's just him trying to get from point A to point B with the cops chasing him the whole time.
Yeah.
And again, that film too has like a little bit of a flashback structure because it starts with him kind of near the end of his route where the police have this whole blockade set up and he kind of just like guns it and is like going full speed and then it cuts back to the beginning of the film.
Oh, really?
And then the whole film progresses and then you realize at the end, like he's gotten back, the film is caught up with itself and now he's like you're about to see how that ends. You know?
I saw it, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
I should revisit that one, huh?
It's a good one. It's, you know, not like a classic or anything, but just some really amazing driving sequences and stunts and crazy jumps and just, you know, 70s muscle cars and all that good stuff.
So it's right here. It's literally the halfway. I paused it at 45 minutes of like a 90-minute film that we learn a little bit about his backstory.
Right.
Because previous to this, we just know that Terrence Stamp has shown up and angry father out for retribution. But then we learned was in prison, career criminal.
Yeah.
Obviously a bad dude. And there's that great line from Bill when he's like, what is England anyway? Like this rinky-dink country where the cops don't even carry guns.
Yeah. I love that.
I love that they're like bagging on England.
And then kind of bagging on the U.S. too, because where does he go to buy a gun? He's like at a school playground, you know?
Yeah.
He's buying guns under the table from these kids who have like backpacks.
And, a little comment there for sure.
Yeah, but the culture difference and him sort of just, you know, again, Wilson being like a fish out of water in this country, you know, where it's very easy to get a gun and where it's all a little bit chaotic and anarchic. Yeah.
Even in the end, that exchange on the plane, you know, when he wants to go home, like you can tell he didn't want to be here for a second longer than he has to be.
Yes. Yeah.
Like this is a guy who loathes LA.
Yeah.
Not just because it killed his daughter, but like he just, he didn't want to be there.
He doesn't belong there. Yeah. He doesn't belong there. He doesn't want to spend any more time there than he absolutely has to.
Yeah. And he doesn't.
Yeah.
So then we meet Nicky Catt. This is when he enters the picture, which is interesting because, you didn't really need this stuff, but there's something about introducing this third element, like this wild card thing, that I think really spices up a film.
Yeah.
You could have cut all of this out and just made it even more streamlined, but there was something about this that really worked.
Yeah, and I mean, Nicky Catt has some of the funniest lines in the film. I love him. Whenever he's on screen in anything, like I'm there.
I don't know. I'd tell you to blow it out your ass, but my dick's in the way.
Yeah.
And he's a misogynist and he's racist.
Yeah.
And he's just the worst.
He's the worst, but...
But he's funny.
But he's very funny. He's very kind of just... His delivery is so good.
Yeah.
I don't know
he
if
plays
seen,
a great asshole.
If you've seen that Linklater film, Suburbia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, based on the Eric Bogosian. But man, his character in that is just like the ultimate asshole in all of cinema, like a certain kind of guy.
He's probably like the nicest dude in the world.
I bet he is. But man, I wish he were in more movies. I wish I could just, you know, have a whole Nicky Catt like anthology.
You, that, I mean, I could have seen if there are an extra 10 minutes of him standing at the movie set.
Yes.
Just talking shit. I want to see that extra footage.
It's funny on the commentary, Dobbs really gripes about the scene where they're talking about what's a sliding scale and how does a sliding scale work.
I love that part.
You know, Dobbs is like, what is this Tarantino shit? You know, like the,
so
this
he
kind
didn't
of
even
like,
write that
no,
stuff, right?
That was all kind of like, Soderbergh says he wanted them, he wanted a scene of like these kind of career criminals to just talk about money.
Yeah.
And, you know, and talk about like, because there's this whole class dimension to the film that Soderbergh more or less downplays, although it's still there.
Yeah.
But there was a lot more in the screenplay and what Dobbs was kind of getting at as far as the relative rank of these different criminals and how they fit into the larger kind of hierarchy.
Sure. Uh-huh.
You know, Wilson is much more often he's referencing like his boss back in England.
Yeah.
So you get this idea that in the finished film, he comes off as more of a solitary figure, but in the screenplay, he's a little bit more like he has his place in the ranking as well, and he has people he has to answer to, and even like the Nicky Catt and you know the older hitman that he's like partners with, they're actually supposed to be like he's supposed to be like his uncle,
oh,
you know,
really?
His older uncle and their family, and there's all this other stuff where
weird backstory. You
yeah,
don't need.
Where there was like a scene where maybe they like went home and like had dinner with some relatives and
oh,
stuff.
Really?
And again, Soderbergh is just kind of like, no, that's not what this movie's about, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you could have cut it to begin with. You certainly didn't need that much stuff.
Yeah,
but it's funny you said the Tarantino thing. Like, I love that bit about the sliding scale. The difference is, Tarantino would have made that a 6-minute scene.
Exactly.
And Soderbergh just doles it out enough to just make it slightly off kilter and indie feeling.
Kind of like break the hypnotic spell of the film in a way, because it has been to that point very like floaty and dreamy and, you know, very subjective and contemplative and so on. And when it goes to those scenes, it's much more in that kind of 90s indie alternative vibe. Yeah.
And it's for like 20 seconds.
Yeah. It goes by so quickly. But it just gives like another kind of texture to the film.
One of my other favorite lines during that first Nikki Cat pool scene is when, I guess, D'Alessandro, is that his name?
Yeah, Joe D'Alessandro.
Joe D'Alessandro says, you know, making trouble for someone, which kind? And he has the forever kind.
Yeah, I love
such
that
a good line.
Fun thing about Joe D'Alessandro. So one of the films that he was in, there's a shot of him bare-chested with his head kind of bowed.
Mm-hmm.
And a still from that film was taken to be the cover of the first Smiths album.
Oh, yeah. I know that.
The kind of the purple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
So I had never made that connection because, I mean, I know a decent amount about Warhol and the factory and so on, but Joe D'Alessandro being in this film mm-hmm. and that connection was new to me. It's just very interesting how this film is full of people that have kind of a larger presence in the history of cinema, in the culture, and so on. But it's very, very subtly done.
Uh-huh.
You know, the way
it never feels like stunt casting or anything.
Because like somebody like Tarantino, I think when he casts somebody like a Travolta, it's much more of a flashy, like, I'm going to resurrect this guy's career
look
kind of
thing.
Look
what I'm doing here. Look
and
who
I love
I've
that
pulled
too.
Out.
But you know, this is much more like below the radar, like very subtle.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to be somebody that is interested in the history of film and so on to pick up on the significance of some of these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
He doesn't underline it.
We should talk about the Bill Duke scene. One of my favorite scenes in any movie.
Amazing.
When Terrence Stamp comes in and goes full limey on him. Yeah. And I still say this line to people, Bill Duke's line about, you know, there's just one thing I don't understand. Every motherfucking word you're saying.
Yes, yes.
Such a great line.
Yeah.
And Bill Duke is just so classic.
That monologue, they talk about that it was written down to the syllable. Like, none of that is improvised.
Oh, really?
It's all just like...
Yeah, you can feel it.
Been worked over. And Terrence Stamp just, it's really interesting because I think there's a kind of a theme running throughout the film, the idea of like performance.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that Luis Guzman meets Terrence Stamp's daughter in an acting class, mm-hmm. that Leslie Ann Warren has this kind of like presence in the film world.
Yeah.
That, you know, Nikki Cat is on set and so on.
There's this
idea that like, yeah, everybody's kind of playing their part and kind of going through the motions in a way. And when Terrence Stamp walks into the scene with Bill Duke,
uh-huh.
it's like his monologue. It's his time to be like, have a spotlight on him and uh-huh. really perform and like, you know, use all the Cockney rhyming slang.
Oh,
and,
it's so good.
And just, really, really lay it out there for this guy. And of course, he's also functionally within the story. He's trying to make it very clear that whatever your beef is with Valentine, I've got my own thing,
uh-huh.
and I have nothing to do with whatever it is you're doing.
And he's allowed to do that.
Yeah.
Like, that never comes back around.
Yeah.
Like, they save him in the parking garage.
Yeah.
And then bring him in, and
they don't even arrest the hitmen, because they're there trying to kill, you know, Terrence Stamp. And that's when the kind of the DEA, whatever, like comes in and kind of breaks it up.
Yeah, they beat the guys down, but let them go.
But they just let those guys go because they're not really supposed to be there. You know, you kind of get like they're also like off the grid a little bit in how they're dealing with all these drug cases that they just seize the drugs and burn them. And, you know, they're not really doing things by the book.
I wonder if they figured in more in previous versions or
possibly. Yeah,
it just seems... it all works, but it just seems odd that they pop up and then they're just sort of gone.
Kind of like a red herring in a way, because as I was watching it this time, I was kind of like, when it cut to Nikki Cat and Joe D'Alessandro like playing pool again, I was like, oh, I guess they got out of jail, or no, they were never arrested, you know?
they were
basically just like, you know, they were tackled and put to the ground, but then it was like, all right, you guys, you know, go away.
Yeah. And so everyone's like making their way to Big Sur. And again, Nikki Cat could have gone away, but they introduced
pops back up for a minute.
That third element where they're like, you know, there's probably a bag of money somewhere,
right?
Like,
right.
Let's go get it.
Yeah, yeah. They're just like they're uninvited to this like shootout, you know. And they complicate things and
don't stick around very long either.
Yeah, don't stick around. They're very quickly dispatched and. Yeah, it is interesting that they show up uninvited and it doesn't end well for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's, you know, that's where we are. Let's talk about it. That night where it all goes down.
Yeah.
The end of the film is so, again, sort of sloppy, and it's not slick, and there are like stunt people involved anytime you do stuff like that, but you never feel that way.
No.
It never feels super planned out.
And it doesn't feel like a movie shootout, you know?
No.
It feels very like sloppy and chaotic
and real.
And the way that they're kind of making poor decisions to kind of run out, you know, like they're hiding behind that counter in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and then they just kind of get tired and they're like, screw this, I'm just going out there.
Yeah,
and
that one guy's like, fuck this.
Yeah. And then just gets shot like almost right away. And I think it has much more of a real feel to like, you know, most movie shootouts we're used to where everybody like takes cover, takes up their position. And
right.
They're exchanging fire and it's much more of like a drawn out thing.
Uh-huh.
This is just kind of like the minute you're exposed, like you get shot from some direction you weren't even looking in, you know?
Yeah.
And you're down and you're out.
Yeah. And I like that earlier in that sequence, you don't see Terrence Stamp overtaking anyone.
Right.
You see him like tying a guy up.
Yeah.
But again, the stuff that happens off screen, it's just such a efficient way to do shit.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker.
Yeah.
You don't have to show all that stuff.
And this is where like on the commentary, there was going to be an entire scene. They filmed this with Anne Margaret playing the ex-wife.
I heard about
Peter Fonda. She was going to be at this house because maybe they still shared the house somehow.
Oh, okay.
And Peter Fonda maybe like showed up unannounced. Like he wasn't necessarily planning on being there. It was a last minute decision. And so she was going to have this like 7-8 minute monologue just about what an asshole he was and how he took everything good about the 60s and ruined it.
Wow.
And, you know, it was going to be like the major like statement of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so they shot it. Soderbergh had said to Dobbs, you know, nobody really has like a big network speech in movies anymore, mm-hmm. like a Paddy Chayefsky, like just, you know, a mad as hell kind of speech. And so he's like, wouldn't it be interesting if we had that, you know? And so they shot it, they did it, and
to see that, at least.
I know, I would love to see that. And when they cut it all together, Soderbergh just said that it just ground the movie to a halt for like 7-8 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was all shot kind of in one take. There was no way to abridge it, cut around it or anything. So it was kind of an all or nothing thing. And he's like, I think it just has to go, you know?
Cut Anne Margaret from your movie.
Yeah. You know, Lim Dobbs is like, I still miss it to this day. And, you know, I think.
Yeah, but you know what? It's kind of there anyway. Like feeling he did ruin the 60s.
That's Soderbergh's point is like, there's nothing that we've already gotten the message that this is who this guy is. And so there's really no need to like pause the movie for 8 minutes and hammer that in even harder.
Yeah.
Because we've already understood all that. And we've understood it in maybe 30 seconds or mm-hmm. a minute of screen time versus like 8 minutes, like a showstopper kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think for a filmmaker more than almost any other quality for me, restraint is the thing I admire most.
Restraint and also being willing to cut material that you might like a lot.
Right.
But to have that sense that it's the only thing that matters is the film that people see.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if, you know, you spent 2 days blocking this amazing single take shot and all the fancy camera work and lighting you had to do to get there to that moment. If ultimately the end result, as impressive as it might be, is not like working for the film,
mm-hmm.
then you got to get rid of it. Yeah. You know, it's just as simple as that. And there's certainly a lot of filmmakers that would still give themselves that indulgence and just leave it in there because they think about the crew and the time spent on set and all that.
Right.
Maybe the money that was spent in the budget, et cetera. But I mean, it's just that final picture that matters. And there's an exchange that Soderbergh and Dobbs have on the commentary where Dobbs, you know, says, you know, objectively as a viewer
mm-hmm.
who knows nothing about this film, who didn't write the screenplay, who's just coming in completely blind,
mm-hmm.
I would say this is a good film. I would, you know, happily recommend it to my friends. I think it's a good film.
Yeah.
As a screenwriter, I have all these issues with it, you know?
Right.
And Soderbergh is like, but the only thing that matters is the first thing you said.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit about the screenwriter? That's one person.
I know.
And I got to think about the rest of the entire world who might see this movie, who are just filmgoers. And
I got to listen to that.
Yeah, it's great. It's really great.
Well, it's interesting when you're talking about a filmmaker losing a scene whole cloth that they shot and loved and like how hard that is. I think the reason that's so hard, not because of how much time they took and all the stuff, that probably factors in, but it's an admission of being wrong.
Sure, sure.
And like, I was wrong. We did not need this stuff.
We went off on
And we
on
spent
a
week doing it, and like, I was wrong.
We went off on this kind of wild goose chase. And,
and that's hard to do, I think, as an artist.
Sure.
There aren't many mediums, art mediums like film, where there are so many ways you can reconstruct something and find fault in what you've done, yet still put out like a great thing in the end.
Yeah, film is such a complicated medium too, because it's a medium where, like, for instance, like in a novel, if you had written an extra 100 pages and you just decided to cut it, well, you didn't really waste a ton of money on it.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't involve a whole lot of other people. You just sat there, you know, for a few days and wrote it all out. Maybe it took
I'm
a lot
sure
of
that
effort
happens,
from you.
But I don't think about it happening in novels.
Right, right. But in film, it's kind of like, man, yeah, like we brought in this whole other person, Ann Margaret, who's like a film icon in her own right.
Well, and again, with the interesting casting, that really jibes
to like
the movie.
Resurrect, you know, again, this figure from film history. And so it ties in thematically to the rest of the film. And it is kind of like, ooh, like that's a tough phone call to have to make to say, hey, look, it was nothing wrong with your performance. You did a great job.
Yeah.
You know, the scene on its own is great, but just for the film that I'm making, it's not right. So I have to cut it, but it's nothing personal. And it's nothing flawed in your work. It's my fault, you know, for just thinking we needed it and then changing my mind or whatever. But
I mean, Terry Malick cut half of
Adrian Brody.
Yeah. I mean, completely cut him out, but a lot of other stuff too.
Oh,
out
tons.
Of Thin Red Line.
He was in, and I'm thinking of his most recent film, I think in Song to Song, Martin Sheen had a role in that film. And it's kind of like, hey, it's the reunion of Malick and Martin Sheen, and they made Badlands all these years ago,
I didn't think about that.
Now he's in this new film.
And he cut him out.
He just cut him out.
No love lost.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see that new movie, by the way.
Oh, Radegund, or A Hidden Life, it's called,
You didn't get to see that one yet, did you?
No, it didn't. Right. It didn't play. But as soon as there's a way for me to see it here, I will be there.
All right. So they have the big shootout. I did see. I'm sure you heard this on the commentary track, but I did read one part where Dobbs said that there was a specific line where Bill actually lets Stamp go and decides not to shoot him.
Right.
Because he felt like he had been abandoned by Peter Fonda.
Yeah.
Whereas in the movie, it's just sort of played like he just dies and can't muster the strength to pull the trigger.
Right, right.
But that's a really interesting change.
It's like, I think he's almost deciding, like, as he lays there dying, that he thinks, you know what? Why am I protecting this guy?
Yeah.
You know? Why am I sacrificing my own life to prop up this jerk who
would hide behind me?
He would hide behind me. He would throw me to the wolves to save himself
in a
split second without any regret, you know? So it's kind of like, no, why would I stop you from killing him, you know? Go do it.
What happens to the girl?
She just kind of disappears. Yeah. I think she's still behind the counter in the kitchen, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it just occurred to me that we don't really see.
Because she doesn't run out when like Valentine runs out.
Right.
He abandons her too and just runs out and, you know, runs down onto the beach.
Yeah, that's
but
such
I think
a...
I think she just kind of stays, you know, hunkers down in the kitchen. Yeah.
Well, that end sequence is beautiful. You know, he goes down to the beach and it's just that blue moonlight. Really gorgeous, that rocky seashore.
Yeah.
And that fucking compound fracture.
Visceral.
Like bone poking through the ankle.
Painful.
Yeah. And that scene, like we were talking about earlier, I always liked that scene, but it really, really got to me when I watched it this morning.
Yeah. Just even Peter Fonda's performance, like the emotion in his voice and the.
It's like he didn't mean to kill her.
The genuine regret. That's like one of the genuine regrets of his life because you get the feeling that. He maybe did really have like true feelings for Terrence Stamp's daughter. He, you know, even I think it's his security consultant who says like, "Well, she got to you," you know.
Yeah.
Like, because they're talking about, you know, these guys in the warehouse that died. There's no way anybody can connect them to you.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, "Well, Jenny could have connected them to me." He's like,
"Right."
Well, she could because she'd already gotten to you.
Right.
But, you know, that's why it's sort of implied. That's why she had to go because she got too close. And your whole way of operating is never letting anyone get in there, never letting anyone get too close to you.
Yeah.
And so I think there's even a subtle suggestion that maybe Adhara and Jenny look like favor each other a little bit.
Yeah.
And that he's sort of, he has a type and that he's kind of
trying to replace
her. Yeah. That's another argument going back earlier in the film that Dobbs and Soderbergh have when Dave takes the picture mm-hmm. of Ginny
oh, yeah.
from the house uh-huh. and she's in that frame at the top of the stairs. Uh-huh. Dobbs is sort of like, really? Would his true love that he killed, you know, and had to cover it up and so on, would he really have a picture of her at the top of the stairs every time he walks up the stairs and has to confront that bit about himself in the past and so on?
Yeah, it is a little out of character. Like, he would almost want to act like she never existed.
Yeah, either just, like, never acknowledge her or, you know, I think in Dobbs' mind, he says, you know, it would be more like she was one picture among many in a hallway that
right.
Terrence Stamp would kind of walk past and do a double take and be like, oh, that's Ginny, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas, yeah, he has more of a, it's like an altar almost, you know, you come to the top of the stairs and, like, it's right there and there's no escaping it. And so, yeah, that's another example of, like, as Dobbs puts it, he's like, there's how I wrote it and how I pictured it in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, the real life constraints of the location
right.
and what the production designer might have done yeah. or what the director wanted and so on. So there's like a real, you know, game of telephone that happens with a screenplay making it to film. And even if you kind of feel like you're directing a scene to the letter,
uh-huh.
there's so much that still changes because,
oh, yeah.
as Fritz Lang says in Contempt, you know, in the screenplay, it's words on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And in a film, it's images on a screen.
Yeah.
So there's always a translation. There's always an adaptation happening there. And there's no way to guarantee that even if you direct something just word for word,
right.
that it will resemble what somebody had in their mind when they wrote it.
Yeah, it's the same with reading a book that later gets made into a film.
Totally.
It never, almost never looks like what you picture. There are certain exceptions, of course, like No Country for Old Men stands out to me as
it's like
a movie
perfect
that's like
kind of realization of
realization of a book.
Yeah.
But you know, the ending of this movie, it's really hit me more than ever about the father confronting the surrogate father about the daughter /lover in Fonda's case that they both lost.
Right.
And they I feel like they almost connect there.
Yeah, they do. They realize they have more in common in a way that Terrence Stamp just realizes I can't judge you too harshly.
Like this won't undo my failing.
Yeah,
me killing you,
and it would be dishonest. It just wouldn't be right. You know, he has like an innate sense of right and wrong, I think, mm-hmm. and of justice and so on. And he realizes that he would be a hypocrite. It would be unjust for him to enact this vengeance when he bears just as much of the responsibility. Really,
after he's killed. 1, 2, 3, 4
Yeah. Five people.
And then however many kills that night. It's
probably getting up close to like 8 or 9.
6 or 7, 8.
Yeah.
Like I can't remember whose bullet was responsible
right,
for you exactly.
Right,
but
right.
Yeah, he just lays waste to everyone and then lets them go.
Gets to the very top and he's just kind of like, you know what? You know, it's like somebody says early in the film, maybe it's Guzman or I forget who says it, but it's like you think a guy like Terry Valentine is ever going to understand.
Yeah.
You know, you think he's ever going to really get it in his head that he's the villain, he's the bad guy.
Yep.
When he's just kind of oblivious and he lives this.
He's untouchable.
This bubble existence where, you know, the truth is not allowed to really penetrate that bubble he has around him.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't see what happens to him. I imagine he dusts himself off and goes right back to cleaning his teeth in the mirror
exactly
a week later.
Yeah.
Scarred, but not probably changed.
No.
You know, he's still got his young girl.
Yep.
Although she may bolt after this.
She might say, okay, that's enough.
But we see Terry Stamp, though, on the plane in that great last scene with that woman in that exchange.
Yeah.
And that's where he really brings it home of just like about how bad he wants to get back to England.
And he doesn't say literally that he's been in jail. He says he's been like away on an oil rig or something in the ocean.
Yeah, on an oil rig in the North Sea.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, I did my time, my 9 years. And then my contract was up.
yeah. That's maybe a remnant of this whole idea that, you know, Wilson is like a worker and
right.
he has his sort of bosses and so on that he's responsible to as well.
Yeah.
That he has to do his time, his contract and so on.
And he's getting away with this because Peter Fonda, what he can't do
right.
is call the cops
yep.
still.
Yep.
I guess he has to bury fucking five guys.
Yeah, I don't know how he would have cleaned that up. But obviously he could have called, made some calls and gotten some fixers.
Sure.
And
there's a new fixer.
Yeah.
Just around the corner
exactly.
waiting.
Yeah.
And then that final bit from Poor Cal with him singing the Donovan song, just such a perfect way to end this movie. Perfect way to end it.
And it's funny, when I was watching it this most recent time, and he's, you know, he's playing that song, the Donovan song, and he gets to the end of it, and you know, the woman says, "Oh, that was very good."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Yeah, I'm getting better, aren't I?"
Yeah.
And there's just something so bittersweet about it.
Yeah.
The way, just the disconnection between then and now,
uh-huh.
and everything that's happened in the years in between, and all the regrets and so on.
Yeah.
And just the memory of having been someone young, someone more full of hope, like life still in front of you, and so on. And
could have made better decisions from that point.
Right, right.
Of being petty jewel thief or whatever
and
he
like
was.
And like being able to put yourself back in that place so so fully.
Yeah.
And to remember that particular moment in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, back then it was all still in front of me. It was all still possible to do better. Dobbs on the commentary talks about, he says, you know, I think memory is really like a form of regret. It's when we remember something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not so much the event itself that we're remembering so much as it is we're remembering like a fork in the path,
mm-hmm.
where a decision was made, a choice was made, and we're thinking as much about what could have happened instead as we are what did happen ultimately.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, memories is a very tricky thing. It's like they say, when you remember something, what you're really remembering is the last time you remembered it.
Right.
And the way that our memories over time, over the years, as our perspective changes, mm-hmm. as we change as people, that gives a different, you know, emphasis and color to our memory.
It's a game of telephone with yourself.
Exactly,
almost.
Exactly. And so what really is memory, and what really is, you know, how can we say with any certainty that what we remember is the way things happened? You know, we can't.
Yeah. And that great line early on, when she says, "Do you remember the last time you saw Jenny?" And he says, "I remember every time I saw her."
Yeah. Which, you know, in a way, I mean, he's saying a couple of things there. He's saying that he loved her that much,
mm-hmm.
that it made that much of an impression on him, but also it was in installments. So it's
right.
like, I remember the time I saw her when she was 5. I remember the time she was 15, you know.
I remember every time I saw her because it was 12 times.
There are these snapshots, and each one was very self-contained and well-defined because years went by between those times. And just all the regrets of a father as he looks back on his life and not being there for his child. You know, it's a hard thing. And
all wrapped up in this like kind of bloody
revenge story. I know.
So good.
Yeah.
Man, what a great film.
Beautiful piece of work. Yeah.
You got anything else?
Not really, no. I mean, I was going to talk a little more about, you know, some of the influences coming into this film. Soderbergh wrote a very interesting book in the 90s called Getting Away With It,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of like a book-length interview with another filmmaker, Richard Lester, who made a film called Petulia that was very, very influential on this film in terms of the fragmented nature of the cutting and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The cinematographer on that film is Nicholas Roeg, who, of course, went on to make Don't Look Now, and is also extremely associated with this kind of, many of his films have this kind of jarring editing structure where time is broken up and happening parallel to itself and so on. There's also the films of Alain René, French filmmaker. Soderbergh described this film as sort of Get Carter as made by Alain René.
Yeah.
Who made...
Definitely evokes Get Carter.
Yeah, who made such films as, you know, last year, Marienbad, Hiroshima Mon Amour, and then my favorite of his is called Muriel, or The Time of Return, where... Muriel is very interesting because when we were talking earlier about how this film is very simple in terms of the plot, and that's why it's, you know, why it works, because you have this simple backbone that you can deviate from with the memories and so on. Muriel is like a very complicated plot, and it's more fragmented even than this film.
Yeah.
And when you watch it, it almost, there are sequences that are cut so quickly with these flashes of images that it almost doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And it came out in 1963, and a lot of people felt like René, who had made Marienbad and Hiroshima Mon Amour before this, they sort of felt like, okay, you pushed it too far this time. This is like too fragmented, too just too abstract. But I think it's a really beautiful film. You can get it now on like a Criterion Blu-ray. And definitely if you're interested in, you know, a film that pushes to the absolute limit this idea of showing a character thinking, examining this theme of memory and so on. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do better than that film. So I would encourage anybody to check that out. And then also in terms of the kind of single-minded protagonist that mm-hmm. is just out for revenge, there's a John Borman film, Point Blank, that also comes up quite a bit when they talk about it. And Lee Marvin, you know, and this, he has that same kind of like single-minded determinedness through that film that, you know, he's no nonsense. He's just there to enact his revenge and then just kind of like, you almost get the sense that he could just like vanish into thin air afterwards. Yeah. Like this, his whole reason for existence is to enact this revenge.
Yeah, that's a good rec.
Yeah.
I got one final thought because I forgot to mention, when I was talking about Sarah Flack editing these films, her first film credit, she was a PA on Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Wow.
And then later went on to be his editor. How cool is that?
That's really cool.
And that really speaks to Soderbergh's, you know, to do that, to promote someone up like that.
Absolutely.
You know?
Soderbergh has, because he as an editor himself, because he edits a lot of his own films now.
Yeah, sure.
And I think he's kind of, he's definitely taken up, you know, what Sarah Flack did in this film has continued to kind of be a reference point, I think, for him mm-hmm. in how he cuts his own material now. But Soderbergh began a lot of his early jobs in Hollywood when he was just trying to kind of get a foothold out there were in taking these, I think a lot of the times it was like concert films. Like mm-hmm. I think his first credit as director is this Yes concert film from like 1985.
Yeah, the 80s Yes.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. yeah. And but he had a deal with maybe one of the premium cable stations, or forget who exactly, but they would acquire the rights to these films, these concert films from around the world that were maybe 2.5 hours long. And they would say, we need you to make like an hour long version of this.
Wow.
And so he said from a very early point, he was taking this raw material and rather than just like cutting scenes out or mm-hmm. trimming it down, he was kind of reconceiving the whole thing, like exploding it and then kind of putting it back together. And that's something that has obviously served him very well as a filmmaker now.
Good lessons.
And even on his website, he will put up these experimental recuts of very well-known films. For instance, he has a recut of 2001.
Oh, wow.
I don't think you can get it anymore, but, you know, it was there for a minute.
Wow.
And it's like, or he made a version of like Psycho, for instance,
uh-huh.
where he did a split screen between Hitchcock's version and the Gus Van Sant version.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes just using one or the other to kind of create this like, you know, assembly, like combination cut of Psycho.
Oh, wow.
So he's obviously somebody who is very, very interested in the idea of tinkering with things.
Yeah.
And of
just one of the greats.
Just poking around and you know, forever experimenting. So
I love it. So cool. All right, dude. We'll think offline about what we're going to do next.
Yeah.
Looking forward to whatever that is.
We'll go with something. Something real adventurous. Yeah.
Okay. I don't
know how to think about it. Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.